Now I shall speak to you in a tone like this. You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. On today's Open Source RVA, we'll introduce you to newly elected 1st District City Councilman John Beliles, who talks about the contentious election, his commitment to the arts, and his legislative priorities. We'll also speak to Richmond photographer Susan Worsham and Gordon Stettinius and Amy Ritchie from Candela Gallery about Worsham's new exhibit at the gallery. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. The Virginia legislature has made national news again this year. Unlike in 2012, it was not for a bill forcing people who sought abortions to undergo a medically unnecessary ultrasound, but rather a rapid-fire rewrite of Virginia Senate districts that appeared to stun Governor McDonnell himself. This past Monday, on Martin Luther King Day, a surprise Republican redistricting map was attached to the end of a run-of-the-mill House bill and rushed onto the floor without public hearing or comment. The new map creates a 6th black majority district, and its GOP proponents say it is necessary to avoid lawsuits under the Voting Rights Act, but Democrats counter that it packs black voters into fewer districts and actually dilutes the black vote. The bill passed by a vote of 20-19 as the black Democrat Senator Henry Marsh III, a longtime civil rights lawyer who worked for integration of Virginia schools in the 1960s, was attending the presidential inauguration that day and therefore not around to cast his vote. Part of Marsh's own district has been carved away in the new rendering. If approved, the new districts will go into effect for the 2015 elections, though the governor still has a chance to veto the legislation. He told reporters he certainly didn't think it was a good way to do business. As Richmond Public Schools grapples with yet another budget gap, this one of more than $11.6 million, the school board briefly considered a proposal earlier this month to bring back former Richmond city manager Robert Bob. Bob's return would have been with the purpose of again helping identify cost-cutting strategies, according to Richmond Magazine, which first reported the story. The administration approached us about whether or not we would be willing to have him come and help during the budget process, confirmed school board chairman Jeffrey Bourne, who indicated that the decision to pass was driven in part by the fact that the school administration had made little or no movement on suggestions made by Bob last summer. We felt like spending $50,000 or $60,000 for a consultant wasn't appropriate. The Robert Bob Group, the Washington, D.C.-based consulting firm for which Bob is the president and CEO, was hired last March by a school's task force of business leaders convened by Mayor Dwight C. Jones after the school board presented him with a budget containing a $24 million funding gap. Bob confirmed that he'd been contacted by school's administration and says RPS Chief Financial Officer P. Andy Hawkins acknowledged the value of the group's previous report. Bourne says the board is committed to making on its own what he called the tough decisions. Another effort to broker a happy ending is being proposed in the Firehouse Theater Project debacle that first cleaved the Richmond theater community in December. A group of 4 Richmond theater veterans on Thursday night sent an email letter to the theater board asking to present a proposal that they suggested will allow the board to regain the respect and goodwill of the theater community at large. Controversy first erupted in mid-December when the theater's board voted to oust longtime artistic director Carol Pearsall. Pearsall was one of 5 founders of the storied Richmond Theater Company and had enjoyed a recent run of successful productions that had met with both critical and audience acclaim. Her ouster was unexpected and led to more than a month of protest by shocked members of the theater community. "We definitely recognize that it was time to shift our energies from one of opposition to one of solution," says Adrian Reeder, one of the 4 peace brokers. "We've been focusing our efforts in that direction for a little while now." To that end, Reeder said, the 4 have held fact-finding conversations with 2 former members of the Firehouse board, Georgianne Jones-Broth and James Vigiant, who resigned after the controversy first erupted December 12th with a board vote to force Pearsall's retirement by June 30th of this year. After the vote, Pearsall instead resigned. Reader told Open Source RVA the four also were in communication with Firehouse Board Chairwoman Kay Holmes in an attempt to obtain documents that would shed further light on the controversy and allow them to develop their mediation plan. Based on what they learned in their fact-finding, Reader says, we've developed a proposal or plan of action that we believe would address the source of the conflict and resolve it. It's now just a matter of having the opportunity to seriously discuss that with the entire board. Holmes, who is out of town currently, says she is aware that the four had reached out in a letter, but says she'd not yet seen it before it was shared with her by Open Source. Obviously, I don't know what's in it, the proposal, Holmes said. I don't really know what to say about the proposal at this point. As to whether the board would be willing to hear that proposal, Holmes says the answer is resounding, probably. I can't speak for the entire board, but people are probably willing to listen, Holmes said. It depends on what they're asking to have done. Holmes says she and the board have actively sought to continue negotiations with Pearsall, meeting in a conference call as recently as last night to discuss ongoing efforts to reach out to her. Carytown is the place to be on Sunday afternoon as Rax Luminaire, the return of Pandora's Box, brightens up the Bird Theater. This fourth annual Dance of Lights, sponsored by Kalima Dance, brings together light work, theater, dance, live music, and inventive puppetry from All the Saints Theater. This year's special guest will be international belly dance star Princess Farana, who will share the shine with the Ananda Dance Company, Wicked Hips, Buster Britches, Harry Colettes, and more. The Alchemy begins at 2:30 p.m. at the Bird. For more information, go to raxlumiere.com. That's raxlumiere.com.
Down in the alley, just you and me.
John Belisle has spent his life in politics, or at least in its shadow. The son of former Virginia Governor Gerald Belisle, his playground was Capitol Square. In 2004, after L. Douglas Wilder became Richmond's first popularly elected mayor, a tech-savvy Belisle took to the internet to support the former governor's sometimes heavy-handed efforts to reform city schools and government. Belisle provided the hard facts that made many of Wilder's more aggressive antics seem justifiable. Belisle long insisted he had no taste for elected office. But with November 2012 on the horizon, he at last announced his readiness to take the political plunge. Belisle ran a hard-fought race against 1st District City Councilman Bruce Tyler, and won by a hair's breadth. For months, Tyler postponed Belisle's victory party with court and electoral board challenges, but at long last, Belisle was sworn in earlier this month. I'm here with John Belisle, who is finally the 1st District City Council representative. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Chris.
This was a hard-fought election. You want to talk a little bit about that first, I guess? Maybe just sort of, I guess you're here now, but took you an extra 6 weeks to get here.
Well, I did. I thought it was going to be a long campaign, and it turned out to be a little longer. Election night lasted until late December, but we're here, and I'm really excited about serving on council. It's going to be an exciting 4 years, I hope.
So was that anything in the way of a distraction for you, trying to figure out what your role was going to be on council, and meanwhile you're busy dealing with this legal distraction? Or
no, it was always a little bit more comfortable because we were ahead. If we had been behind, I would have fretted a little bit more. But given the historical situation with recounts and things like that, we knew that they rarely changed, and we didn't think it would, and it didn't. So
still, even if it changed or not, it was a heck of a squeaker.
It was. I tell people it was a 1,000 piece puzzle, and had any one of the pieces been taken out, I would have lost. And that goes from people sending $25 checks to all the people that volunteered to be at the polls on election day to people that called their neighbors or sent out emails and said, you know, hey, we support John because X, Y, or Z. Take any one of those pieces away, and I'm not here.
You're lucky none of your voters got lost under the couch.
Exactly.
So moving on, I guess, into the new year, the new 4 years, I guess, that face you now. You're going to be not on finance, as I understand. You're going to be land use?
Correct. I'll be chair of land use, housing, and transportation. And that was a decision made by Council President Samuels because of my last 3.5 years in the planning department, working on housing issues and some transportation issues, and of course, you know, land use. I'll be a member of government operations, which is where a lot of the auditor reports come in, which is always a good way to clean up. I think one of the things that we need to do in the city is improve our technology by vast leaps and bounds, and that's a good committee to look into things like that.
The technology you're talking about, the city, its ability to interact with people in the 21st century, or are you talking
not only that, but for instance, the code inspectors were in my department, and they had a laptop, they had a camera, and they had a cell phone. And in this day and age of technology,
you'd have
an iPad or a tablet or just a cell phone can do all of those things.
Yeah.
And rather than carry all those different pieces of equipment, you know, use an iPad. It has everything in it, you know, contained within the unit, and they're cheaper.
Back to land use, sometimes that can be a little slow in the city. The city is fairly well developed out, although we've had some interesting projects of late, and it looks like, as you're coming in, that this might be a busy season for land use.
It could be. I mean, it's, you know, the economy's starting to pick back up a little bit, and we've seen some development projects coming through. VCU is kind of somewhat capped the number of students, but they're still looking for housing.
Still building,
so
yeah.
People are still, you know, building units, and VCU may decide to grow further based on land use decisions that we make. So I think that will be critical, but you know, the two of us kind of need to walk together on that. You don't want the school to grow without the housing, and vice versa.
I'm with John Belisles, who's finally the first district's representative on city council. The West Hampton school itself, I'm curious about. There's been talk of the possibility that school might be lost in whatever happens over there. Bon Secours is talking medical offices. We've heard rumors about a cancer institute, maybe even the children's hospital. It seems small for that, but the school itself has a lot of history. It's a 100-year-old school almost. It's part of a repository, really, of a relatively acclaimed architect's work. And it was actually Warren Beatty and
Shirley
MacLaine's dad was a principal there. So there's some history with that building. It's a neat building. It's an Art Deco style building. How do you save that, or do we need to save it?
Well, I definitely would love to save it if it's possible. And I know that Historic Richmond Foundation has been working with Bon Secours to look at the feasibility of keeping the building, if not the building, at least the facade, and build off the back of it. I have no idea what their plans are at this point, but my guess is that the neighborhood would love to see that building saved. It's my understanding that the building itself is about 60,000 square feet, and that
it's a big building. It's got a basement, which has been
talked
about as a problem, but it seems like that'd be useful if you were needing to deal with all the physical plants.
Well, and if the plan that everybody has looked at is a 75,000 square foot building, you're not talking about a huge addition if they can utilize all 60,000 square feet. I had no idea the building was that big, but it, you know, hopefully that means they can add on something that is, you know, not out of character with the neighborhood, and certainly in character with the existing structure.
So maybe you save it.
I would love to see that. I mean, it is an iconic building. It has, like you said, it has so much history, but its presence is pretty special to that neighborhood.
It's an anchor.
It is.
I wanted to talk about something that you were involved in, very involved in, co-founded, I guess, for Richmond in the last year or so, is the Street Art Festival. Is that coming back?
It is. Ed Trask and I started that last April, or we held it last April. We started it long before that. It took a while to get there, but it was a big success, and it turned that power plant building down on the canal into a destination, and that it's actually where they're holding the TEDx convention in March, and it's brought a lot of visibility to that building. It's something that I'm overwhelmingly humbled but proud of, because it helped that it was 75 and sunny all weekend. But
crossing fingers now.
Yeah, exactly. Knocking on all kinds of wood. But it was something that people came out. People, I mean, we had people from 5 years old to 85 years old, and they came out to watch these artists paint, and it really shows the transformative power of public art. And it's something that is catching on worldwide. Street art is, but public art is getting its due. And you know, this city has got such a great arts and cultural community. I think it was fitting that all of that and the G40 and the Art 180, all of that came out this year and really got noticed, because it's important to the city.
Now it's funny you should mention, I guess, we've had some controversy, I guess, with some of our public art over the last couple of years. The Art 180 project in particular, we think of Parker as our new arts guy on city council, but you've been, again, talking about this street art festival, you've been very active and involved in the arts and promoting them. How is that going to factor into your work on city council?
Well, you know, I was fortunate enough to grow up in a family that kind of relayed the importance of art and culture. And beyond the street art festival, when I was at the city and planning department, I was secretary of the Public Art Commission and also in other ways promoting the arts. And before that with RiverCityRapids.com, and still doing that. But the way I like to look at it, and the way I think more people should look at it, is the arts in Richmond has the economic impact of a Fortune 500 company. They're all small. You know, you take all the small galleries and add them up with the opera, the symphony, the ballet, et cetera, et cetera. They employ hundreds and hundreds of people and generate millions of dollars of economic development. And people come down to see a show at Virginia Repertory Theater, and they do that first. They go across the street to 27 and have dinner, or they go to Pasture, or Rappahannock, or 525, and then they go see a show at Center Stage. It has an enormous impact on this city, and we've been very lucky over the last 4 years since the economy kind of went down
that we've sort of kept that going.
That we haven't lost any of the major performing groups. We haven't lost, you know, anything
seems,
that a lot
like
of other cities
it
have.
It seems like it's been in spite of itself that we've been able to do that.
Well, and part of that is, you know, one of the things that excites me is that because Parker and I are now on council, we have an opportunity. It's our job. It's an addition to our job to bring other people along with us and show the transformative power and the economic impact that the arts have. And hopefully we'll be able to step up the city's participation in promoting that and helping those organizations.
Signage and tourism have been, for you, something that you occupied quite a bit of your time while you were still with the city as an employee.
Right.
Where do we stand right now, I guess?
Well, I think I'm having a meeting in about 10 days to get caught up to speed. I haven't been at the city since June, so I'm not exactly sure where the progress, where they are on the progress to this point. We essentially spent some time with a design firm from New York that came down, created a really good strategy for signage, for vehicular sign, wayfinding, and little streetwalk kiosks with little maps and things like that. And
what our bus company doesn't do for us.
Anyway. So they've identified the two most heavily trafficked areas for tourists, which is the boulevard from basically the Diamond to Maymont, and essentially the downtown area defined by about Venture Richmond's boundaries, which is basically VCU down to Church Hill over to Manchester. And they've come up with a strategy for a design, signage. We had a big group of stakeholders from all those destinations and city officials and business leaders, and we developed it. If I remember correctly, it has gotten the Urban Design Committee approval, which means the next step would be Planning Commission. I'm not sure when it's coming up to Planning Commission,
well,
but
this is a long process.
It is. But I'm very confident that people will be very happy replacing those really ugly blue and green signs that are currently directing people to places like the Marine Raider Museum and
things that don't exist anymore.
And First Tee, right. And so it's a better system. It's taken a little bit longer. Part of the problem is,
I think there's one that says City of Manchester this way, right? Isn't there?
I'm not sure on the blue and green signs, but you know, part of the problem was that was a project that I was spearheading, and when I left it, one of the people that was helping with it was on maternity leave, so it got delayed a little bit longer. But I'm pretty confident it's going to be a really good project. So I'd like to think those will be going in the ground pretty soon, next few months.
So those things, wayfinding, all of that plays into some of what was Rachel Flynn's dream of a riverfront plan, and this city that's a walkable city that is recognizing its main thoroughfare, which is the James River. That's been a passion for you too, right?
It has. I love the river, and it's I love going down there. It's one of the neatest places to go in Richmond is the James River when it's flooding, and you go down there and you see the power of it. Even if you don't go out to Belle Isle, just walking along the land there by Dominion and Tredegar, it's pretty amazing. And the riverfront plan is. I've lived in Richmond all my life. I've seen a lot of plans come and go. I've seen a lot of plans ignored. But the interesting thing about this riverfront plan is it laid out short, medium, and long-term goals, but it also came with price tags for those goals. And in that way, it's kind of unique. And so it makes it easier for the city to identify what we can get done short-term that people can see and get excited about, and then they make sure that we follow up with the medium and long-term goals. And so
or continue to see. I have to say it was pretty amazing seeing that what the city did had an almost immediate effect on what the regional planning district was looking at for Route 5.
Right. And if you remember back a couple of years ago when they did the cultural action plan and they did all those surveys of people all over the region, the number one thing that people identified with was the James River. And, you know, that's been kind of personified by Outside Magazine Best River Town Ever Award that we got last year. And I think that's testimony to what we've done. I spent 2 hours with Ralph White last month walking around Belle Isle before he retired. Because
you're taking over his job?
No, I am not. No, okay. But I could never fill Ralph's shoes. But I wanted to make sure, and every time I go hear Ralph speak or talk to him,
as long as he doesn't pass his shorts on to you.
No. I always learn something from Ralph. He's so knowledgeable, but he's so passionate about the river, and it's important that we have people that are as passionate or half as passionate as Ralph is. And you know, he's retiring, but he's not going anywhere. He's going to be an advocate, I think, and that's important.
We're hearing again some of these rumors and talks of a ballpark down in Chaco Bottom, and more recently, within the last couple of weeks, I've been hearing that there may be something imminent. In fact, by the time this broadcast happens, we may have heard something new. Are you hearing anything on that end?
I haven't heard that anything's imminent, but I have heard the reports of the city looking at the Chaco site again. I haven't seen anything. People have told me that, you know, it would be in the same site as the one that they proposed 4 or 5 years ago. But, you know, the key, if you're going to pull something like that off, is financing. And I told people when I was knocking on doors this summer, you know, my heart would love to see a downtown stadium, but the most important thing above all else is that we cannot lose this franchise. The Flying Squirrels are one of the most engaged organizations of any stripe I've ever seen in Richmond. And, you know, I remember when their first season,
it was huge,
but about July of their first season, I was driving down Thompson Street and there was a guy standing at the stoplight asking for change in a Flying Squirrels t-shirt. And that's that's how permeating they've been in society. And yeah, I told people, I said, I don't care if they put the stadium on top of City Hall. Can't lose the Squirrels for...
Could be a good idea.
It could be. For two reasons. One is because they're such a great franchise and they're so engaged. But two is it's an economic development issue. If we lose two baseball teams in 5 or 6 years, we're never going to be able to get businesses to look at the city and say, we want to relocate there, or, you know, this city is doing good things.
With the, and it is related, I guess, to the riverfront plan, but the Chaco plan, that little small area plan that they've been developing, which doesn't involve a baseball stadium per se, but does involve some major transformation of 17th Street Marketplace. It does involve continuing Franklin through the train shed and really kind of creating some linkages. And again, this walkability, maybe some space for a Black history or a slave history museum that might be able to go in there. How do you think a ball stadium might, I mean, that almost seems like too much culture down there.
Well, it depends. I mean, I don't know if you can
run it over.
I don't know if you can get too much, but it depends. If you can make all those things work together, then you've got an overwhelming kind of area that offers something literally for everyone.
And I guess that's it. Is that, how do you make all those things? It's almost like a perfect storm getting all of those things to work together.
It is, and you've got to have a good navigator.
I hope we have a good navigator. I'm still with John Belisles, who's the first district city council person, finally. And going to finish off, I guess, our conversation just talking a little bit first about the school budget. They were deeply in the hole last time. It was time to work on the budget, I think $24 million. This time there's some forecasts of them again being 10 to 14 or $16 million behind where they need to be. This has become sort of the problem du jour, I guess, is school funding, improving our schools. What are you hearing in terms of I know the city is already gearing up to deal with what they know is going to be a significant issue, funding our schools.
Well, it is a significant issue, and one of the biggest concerns are the teacher furloughs, because I've heard from concerned parents in the district that they're worried because teachers of their children are looking at other opportunities in other localities or just other professions, and that's a huge concern. You know, we have to look at everything top to bottom. I was very encouraged by the news this week, the first school board meeting. They've asked for an audit. I think the last audit was done about 5 years ago, and we will see how much progress has been made, but the seven new people on the school board and a whole different attitude mentality is going to be critical, because they are going to have to make, they've got the mandate to change the way things are done, and they need to look at everything, and they need to start by protecting the teachers in the classroom first and foremost. That is the keep of the castle. Everything else, if they have to merge with the city, technology or you know, cleaning services, maintenance program, whatever, they need to look at that first and foremost and protect what's in the schools, because, you know, without doing that, we're going to lose teachers and we're going to lose our residents' faith in the system. And it's, you know, in my district, we've got Mary Munford, which has been immensely successful, and that was built up over many years with Greg Music, you know, taking the lead.
Principal there.
And you're starting to get a groundswell for Albert Hill. People are starting to look at that as a serious option. We've got a new principal there, Ms. Jones from New York, and she is doing a tremendous job. She's only been here 6 months, but everybody is encouraged, and I think that.
And again, you're land use guy now, and there's probably no bigger land use than your schools and your district. This is what drives home prices.
It is. I can't tell you how many people I met this summer and fall knocking on doors, and they were 20 or 30 somethings, and they had either just moved here with kids, or they just moved here to start a family, and they all lived in the Munford district because they want to be able to walk their children to Mary Munford every day. And that is a huge issue. And to get those people to stay here for 20 years, we have to make sure that by the time they're infants or their toddlers that today aren't even in Munford graduate from TJ. We don't have time to waste, but we've got to start on the plan. And Albert Hill is already moving in that direction, and we've got to start getting to work on Jefferson.
The other thing I'd like to talk about, speaking of housing, again, is affordable housing. Mm-hmm. You've been somewhat involved in that as well, and there's quite a lot of talk. In fact, I met with Peter Chapman just before Christmas, talking a little bit about that, an update on where things are. Hopefully, we're going to have him on the show sometime soon. Mm-hmm. What are your priorities there?
Well, one of the focus areas of my work with the planning department was housing, code enforcement, blight abatement, vacant building strategies. We spent 2 years getting receivership legislation through the General Assembly that allows us to go in and fix up houses without it's not eminent domain. It doesn't take the property from somebody, but if somebody, a slumlord, persistently refuses to meet code requirements or fix up houses, then we can go in and do it. It's a complicated process, but all of these tools together can really turn neighborhoods around. So if you have a street with four vacant buildings on it, and you can turn that around, the street gets better, property values go up, and it becomes safer, and people want to live there.
I've been curious about that. All of that effort to allow the city to go in and abate these issues, and it's been a historically a huge problem with some of our slumlords, and there are some really big ones. Some of them have made headlines for some mm-hmm. of the things they've done or have not done, but then there are quite a few homes in the Richmond metro area that are not up to speed, so to speak, because the families who live there, who've lived there forever, just can't afford it. And we've seen some push-pull strains over this. Union Hill is one when mm-hmm. they were going for their
designation,
historic district designation, and a lot of the community objected to it because they were worried that now they're going to have to, you know, paint their doors a certain color, and they've got to spend more on the siding so it's historically accurate. How do you balance some of what those regulations allow you to enforce with not, you know, forcing gentrification on people?
Well, the strategy that I'd like to see the city pursue is not one where people go in and buy houses and, you know, make them, you know, spend a ton of money renovating them and driving the property values up. We're talking about houses that are falling apart or vacant and fixing them up to what's, for lack of a better word, kind of a Lowe's house, mm-hmm. you know, standard stuff, not expensive, but livable. Purchasing today is somewhat of a challenge with loans
financing
and all that. So what we're looking at is taking some of the worst and using the ability to fix those houses up to stabilize a neighborhood or to keep a street from falling into a complete, crime-ridden area where all of a sudden you've got drug problems and prostitution, things like that. And, you know, those are things that need to be addressed. You've seen some of that in parts of Church Hill where younger people have come in and people have fixed houses up and they've moved in or they move in and they fix them up themselves while they live there.
It's encouraging seeing ideas like storefront,
for community design,
which has that sort of as its nonprofit, private, so to speak, mission. Coming in and helping people to do that, both getting them the resources to figure out what it's going to look like when they fix it,
sure.
and getting them the paint and the siding as well.
Right, and there are other programs too for like elder homes and some of those other programs that the city doesn't fund directly, but they are out there and they are able to help people that if a porch starts to fall apart, they can come in and help stabilize it or fix it. So you know, we need to do a better job of promoting those for people that need it.
Do you think some of the bigger ideas around affordable housing, public housing, maybe more specifically public housing, are realistic that the city is pushing towards? Things like going in, not Gilpin yet, but some of the other courts, Creighton, I think, is on the list.
Well, I think part of the whole solution is, the answer to your question is yes. I think some of it is doable. And I know that people in the city have visited Atlanta, and Atlanta has had a lot of success.
Great deal of success.
And so I think that's a good model to follow. It always takes political will, which is sometimes difficult. But part of the whole strategy is the city has about 500 to 600 vacant buildings that are in really bad shape. And part of the strategy that I want to pursue, and part that, that receivership will help, and better blight abatement will help, is you can fix those houses up, and they're in, you know, regular neighborhoods with regular middle income people, and or lower to middle income, and in some areas with higher income. But if you fix those houses up, you can place people there that maybe, like you said today, how are you going to get them out of Creighton Court? Where are they going to go? And if you fix some of these houses up that aren't that expensive to live in, and this person, you know, they may have a job, they may be able to afford the rent or the mortgage, then those houses by nature are spread out all over the city. So you can deconcentrate poverty by fixing some of these. The houses are all, we've got a list of it, and it's, unfortunately, it's long, but if you look at the addresses on a map, they're everywhere. And so you're not just replacing one court with another court and packing people in. You're sending them out into different neighborhoods, and all of a sudden they become just like the neighbors. They start going to work, and they start being productive, and they start being part of the community and watching out just like those other neighbors that are right next door.
It's a good vision to have.
It's not something that's going to get solved overnight, that's for sure, but it's a...
Because it sounded lovely.
Well, it's a long battle, and all of those types of issues are. But if you lay out the roadmap, you know, there'll be a few detours, but at least you know where you're going to get going to.
All right, I'm with John Belisle, First District City Councilman at last, and thank you again for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, have a great day. Have a great 4 years.
I hope so. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Cliche goes that a picture's worth a thousand words. If that's so, then Richmond native and photographer Susan Worsham has a lot to say in Bittersweet on Boswick Lane, her first solo hometown show. The winner of a 2012 Teresa Pollock Award, Worsham has been called one of the superstars of contemporary Southern art by Oxford American Magazine. And that's because her images tell stories, personal, funny, quizzical, and heartbreaking stories of growing up in Richmond. An ongoing pictorial saga that trains the lens on elderly Southern ladies, ancient persimmon trees, frisky snakes, and strangely beautiful bacteria. Bittersweet on Boswick Lane is currently on display at the photo-friendly Candela Gallery on West Broad Street. Susan Worsham joins us today on Open Source RVA, along with Gordon Stettinius and Amy Ritchie from Candela Gallery. Susan, you're a native of Richmond. Tell me about your background and how you first got started in and interested in photography.
Background in Richmond, I grew up on U of R property, and my dad taught chemistry at University of Richmond, and we actually lived on a street where only professors lived. You had to work at the university to be there. So it was a really kind of close-knit group. Getting into photography came a lot later, actually, not until I went to college. And instead of going to University of Richmond, which in a sense I should have gone to, I kind of, you know, left and went to VCU, the art school. I went off the lane far away to VCU. I didn't actually go into photography. I was in graphic design. And I would say I probably only had about 4 photography classes. But okay. It's just something that I always kind of did for myself. So right. While I'm doing projects for school, the photography I always kind of did for myself. Growing up, you know, with growing up on Boswick Lane, which is this particular show is called Bittersweet on Boswick Lane. Growing up on Boswick Lane, my dad passed when I was in the 3rd grade. And I remember the first time I ever kind of witnessed death was I used to always look out of this big, beautiful picture window in our front yard, and this bird flew into the window. And then it kind of died. And that was my first little, you know, glimpse of death. And then later my dad died when I was probably in fifth grade. But my favorite story about my dad, because he was a chemistry teacher, he came to my school when I was in the third grade, and he took flowers and he dipped them in liquid nitrogen and he smashed them on our desks. And I was like, ah, that's amazing.
That's so cool.
Really neat.
The exhibit is on display at Candela is actually a selection of images from a larger body of work.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Some Fox Trails in Virginia. Is that right?
Some Fox Trails in Virginia.
Why were these images selected from that?
Well, because I keep on working further and further in the series. Some Fox Trails in Virginia, the title is kind of, you know, an all-encompassing kind of umbrella for the work, and it's based on the title of a book that was written by my father's ancestors on his mother's side, and they were foxes. So it's called Some Old Fox Trails in Virginia, and for me, it kind of delineates my path in Virginia.
Right.
So where the foxes settled, this is my kind of personal path in Virginia. And a lot of people actually thought, you know, aren't you done with that series, Some Fox Trails in Virginia? And I'm like, it's kind of getting, I'm getting deeper and deeper into it. And kind of funny, I never intended to photograph my childhood home or my neighbors.
But it's become your subject.
It's my subject. It's healing me. It's kind of, you know, the work that's known the most at the moment. But I was just taking my boyfriend to see my childhood home. And we knocked on the door, and the gentleman that lived there at the time was a biology professor. And so I knocked on the door, and I was like, do you mind if we look around, kind of show my, you know, my boyfriend around? You know, I grew up here. And he was like, oh, go ahead. He's like, don't mind me. I'm cleaning out my snakes' cages. And I was like, wow. So we go upstairs to my childhood bedroom, and there was a snake on the bed. Now, I was really scared of snakes growing up, I mean, really scared, to where my mom actually would say, there's never going to be any snakes in your room.
Right.
So the minute I saw that, it was so ripe with metaphor, imagery, you know. I asked the gentleman, can I come and take a photograph tomorrow? And I took a photograph of my mom's wedding picture on the bed, and he placed the snake down on her blanket. And that's the image that started the whole series. Which is, and kind of started, you know, my new Fox Trail or my new path with doing this personal, more personal work. Because my mom always promised there'd never be any snakes in my room. And now that she's gone and she can't protect me, you know, there are. So
do images come to you like that? Do they pop in front of you, or do you ever go out and actively seek out something?
Both. They pop out in front of me a lot. You know, again, that's not something that I had expected. The next thing that I did was I decided to photograph, you know, some of my neighbors. Not expecting that much. Just, you know, thought it would be a good idea. So I went to my old neighbor, Margaret Daniel, and she is my oldest neighbor, and she's at the very top of Bostwick Lane. She was there, you know, my whole life. She was there when I was brought to Bostwick Lane, and my brother was brought to Bostwick Lane. So anyway, I'm photographing Margaret in the basement, and there's this sheet hanging up, and I wanted to take down the sheet so I could put up this old faded watercolor of her daughter, and the sheet had my dad's initials on it. I was like, Margaret, are those my dad's initials? And she's like, well, of course they are. I'm like, you kept this sheet so white. And I took it down, you know, and took her portrait. And while I was taking her portrait, she told me the story of my brother's last day. Now, my brother was paralyzed in a motorcycle accident when I was younger. I was probably about 18. And it was his first visit home. And he wanted to be upstairs in his room. And Margaret told me the story of his last day. She was like, Susan, I stayed home from Sunday school, and I made your brother his favorite, my homemade bread. And I took it up to him, I buttered a piece, and he kept on saying, Margaret, can I have some more of that bread? And she's like, Susan, he finished the whole loaf. And then he said to me something I'll never forget. Margaret, I have everything I could ever want at my fingertips. And then she said to me, I didn't know he had a gun underneath his pillow. So then her and my mom went for a walk down the lane, and when they had come back, he had shot himself. So her telling me that story, you know, first I have the snake on the childhood bed.
Yeah.
And the second image, I have a portrait of her and this story, you know, and then I kind of start to say, wow, there's a lot here. There's a lot here that maybe I haven't dealt with.
Right.
And then, you know, I would go to her house because my childhood home no longer looked the same. Her house looked exactly like it did when I was growing up. Her basement, exactly the same. The color in her bedroom was the same color in my mom's bedroom of the paint on the walls because the same gentleman built both houses. So it's really quite amazing, and I actually found old coloring books in the basement of ballerinas and, like, my name scribbled on them.
Right.
But another thing that I found in her basement, I call Margaret my black walnut bride, and something I found in her basement were all these boxes, and they were labeled by years. And I went upstairs, and I was like, Margaret, what are all those boxes in the basement labeled by the years? And she's like, well, honey, those are my walnuts. I'm like, your walnuts? And she's like, those are my black walnuts. And so she collects them. She brought black walnuts with her from her home in North Carolina. She's from the Great Smokies in North Carolina, Haywood County. And she had brought some when she married Harrison Daniel, who taught history at University of Richmond. So she married him. And so in a sense, this is kind of her dowry of sorts. She has these black walnuts, and she's eating them. And I guess one takes in the ground. And I kind of like to say that, you know, the walnut tree that took that day grew and had roots on Bostwick Lane like I did. Mm. And so now it's like over 50 years old.
And you can hear her voice in the exhibit, right? You've got audio of Margaret.
I've got audio of her telling me how to crack walnuts, you know? She's like, my daddy did them like this. And you actually hear her cracking them. And then she also calls the walnuts. She's like, we got to get out the goodies. We got to get out the walnut meat. Mm-hmm. And then her husband calls the walnut shell the bones. So it's like, you know, getting the meat out of a story, getting the meat off the bones. And she actually said when I was audio taping her, she actually said it's kind of like animals getting the meat off the bones. Because the most interesting thing about her is she was a biology professor. So she taught at collegiate for over, I think it's 23 to 25 years, and she taught biology. So, you know, she's now kind of teaching me about plants and about all sorts of things. And so a project or a series that I thought was about loss and death, now I'm kind of finding it's about growth and rebirth. Mm-hmm. And there was a line in my brother's suicide note, and it says, I arrived home just about the time the honeysuckle blooms. And I thought that was so beautiful because, you know, he was in the army, that he didn't tend to notice the flowers very often, but that day he did. And so now me and Margaret are kind of going in her garden and we're noticing the flowers, you know, and dissecting them and looking under a microscope.
Gordon Stettinius, owner of Candela Gallery, what attracted you to Susan Worsham's work?
Susan's been really interesting to me for some years, actually. We met 5 or 6 years ago, and I think I saw probably the beginnings of this work, if I'm not mistaken, just some of the earlier images, and met her in Los Angeles at a portfolio review type of event. And so she was just another person from Richmond, and so we had to meet. You know, we had to go find each other, and we had a beer, I think. And and it was actually just somebody that I was just newly connected to and kind of left as friends with. And then over the last 2 or 3 years, I guess I've been positioning myself in a place where I could exhibit work or feature artists, and she's been sort of on the brain the whole time. We've been kind of nudging and nagging and trying to get her to maybe give us a listen and think about putting some work up, and she always had kind of a, you know, I'm working on this, and, you know, I'm exploring this now, and always she had news, but, you know, we're trying to get her to sort of come on board. So we're excited to be working with her, and I think that, I guess the reason I'd be drawn to her is I think she thinks a little bit differently than a lot of my peers. You know, a lot of times reality is kind of the basis of photographic work. People are dealing with depictions of things. And I think in many ways, Susan's photographing things that aren't there. And I find that to be really intriguing. And so the story and the ephemera, the installation piece, I just think that she's got a really sort of unique and charismatic way of presenting visual imagery.
Talk a little bit about Candela itself. It's at 214 West Broad. It's in a beautiful, beautiful space. In fact, it's a gallery. You could hang in a gallery. You're a well-known photographer yourself, Gordon. Talk about Candela's mission. It's pretty much an all photography space, right?
Yeah, it's all photography. I do have some other interests, I guess you might say, but for some reason, I'm feeling like a photography gallery, something that features only photography, is probably the canniest play, I think, because I feel like that distinguishes us from some others. And I've made a few books. I guess publishing came first, and through publishing those books, I started kind of drawing some attention, and I brought the attention of a couple of fairly well-known photographers. Mm-hmm. And I'm by working with them, I started thinking, okay, well, maybe I ought to maybe put this work up on the wall and see what happens. And Richmond's been incredibly supportive of us, and so there's been a little bit of a left turn sort of mutation here and there, but just by working with photographers and then deciding to hang the work, I feel like we've gotten off to a really nice start. And we've got some cool things planned. We've got other books that we're working on, and we've got a great show kind of lined up behind Susan. But for the moment, we're just sort of enjoying working with her.
Amy Ritchie, Associate Director at Candela, is that it?
Yes,
Associate Director?
That's the official title.
Well, you also publish the excellent local arts blog, RichmondArtsReview.com, and you cover the visual arts for Style Weekly. Can you take your Candela employee apron off just for a minute and give me your thoughts on whether or not photography is really taken seriously around here as an art form?
Oh, definitely. I think photography in Richmond, it's one of its absolute strengths in the arts, and it's also just getting a lot of attention nationally, the artists, the photographers that we have here. That's actually how I met Susan, was from Richmond Arts Review and reaching out to her to do work, you know, write about her. And we ended up just having coffee talk where I would listen to her talk about her work, and I just fell in love over and over again with her and with Margaret and with every bit of her her story. So this is kind of an everything coming together in one spot for me with the gallery and Susan and Richmond Arts Review. So
let me throw this one out to everyone. What makes a good photograph? Is it the style of the photographer, or is it the statement they're trying to make? What makes each of you go, ah, this is it?
It's something in your gut for me. Sometimes it's color. Sometimes it's a look on someone's face. Sometimes it's the story, and the story that may not be actually told, but the story that you get get from looking at an
image.
Yeah,
I got a lot of that out of your stuff, actually. Yeah. Amy, Gordon?
I'm going to say I think it's the same thing that is important for any work of art, not just photography, but it's that expression of universality. That, you know, whether it's the most detailed or the most broad spectrum, the work speaks to the human experience, which is so complicated and rich. And that's what is a good photograph to me, or a good painting, or anything.
Gordon, as a photographer yourself, how do you know when you've made an image that is everlasting?
I feel I'm most drawn probably to narrative as well. I have a kind of a secondary idea too, though, that I'm really pretty passionate about the object. I'm very into analog photography and alternative process, and I kind of fetishize sort of the material sense of things as well. I like marks made by hand, or even the construction of the imagery made by hand, or there's a lot of ways in for me. I don't necessarily always embrace some of the more, you know, classical, formal types of things. I tend to maybe be a little scuzzier underneath. I like things that have some feeling and some emotion. And Susan's work has kind of this combination of beauty and forensic poetry that seems like a, you know, you can't just like get it in a snap sort of sense, and so you have to spend time with it. It's actually challenging work.
Yeah, there's one called that I love called Bruise Landscape. I stared at that for a long time.
It's actually it's a picture of his backyard, and I went to visit him, and he had these little Polaroids with him. It's one of my older neighbors, and he was like, I looked at his hand, and I was like, oh my gosh! I was like, Ernie, your hand is amazing. Look at your bruise. And he was like, you like my bruise? I'm like, yes. Can I photograph it? And I get very excited. So that's the instance, like you're asking, of a photo just happening.
Right.
So they were surveying the backyard, because the backyard had been hit by a lot of, you know, when hurricanes come through, a lot of trees. So they were surveying the backyard, and he happened to have some old photos of the backyard. And I looked at his hand, and I looked at this image of the little Polaroid from 73 of his backyard, and it looked like it had a bruise on it, which I think was a camera strap that mm-hmm. he probably accidentally got
in there.
Yeah. But his hand, the veins look like rivers, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
And his hand was bruised, and the Polaroid was bruised. And what I'm trying to talk about in my work, it's like a bruised landscape. It's like my stain on the landscape, you know, the things that happen to you in your life mm-hmm. kind of become stains or bruises, like of a ripe fruit that, you know, has lived a little, gotten right. played around with the hand, so now it has a little bit of bruisedness to it.
Gordon Susan's exhibit's going to be on display through February 23rd. What's next for Candela?
We have an artist out of Florida named Maggie Taylor, who is somebody we're real excited to work with. She's, I guess in a nutshell, you might say it's digital collage. She uses sort of Victorian sourced imagery mm-hmm. and creates these pretty surreal vignettes, sometimes humorous, sometimes a little twisted. And she's going to be, I think, well received. You know, you might actually hook a different audience
yeah.
in some ways with this work than with another body of work, but she's very curious, I think. And then a couple out of New Orleans, Louvier and Vanessa, are pretty long-term friends as well, but very notable artists in their own right, and they're very materially indulgent, mm-hmm. and they have kind of a it's humanist work. It's based upon models, but they really, you know, they add gold leaf and they add varnish and blood, and materially they sort of I guess expand sort of the medium a little bit out by process. And then besides that, we've got another event coming around in the summertime, Unbound, which is a sort of an invitational mm-hmm. and a juried affair, and it's about raising money and trying to...
This is your second one of those?
It's our second time right. we've done this, and that's really wide open. I try to invite some name photographers just so I have a little bit of marketing sort mm-hmm. of heft, you know, I yeah. can talk about, but otherwise I don't really care who you are, and we try to get an exciting and kind of enigmatic collection of work, and then we have a party, big party. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll be trying to... get a little PR one day down the road, maybe, because it's a good time and we're trying to earn a little money and further what's a collection that I hope one day to donate to a notable institution. So that's a cool idea. And then all the while we're working on a few different books. I'm trying to, they're still cloudy to me right now. There's mm-hmm. a few things I like, but I have a distributor who I also have to pay attention to, and I, you know, try to get them excited as well. And I'm sort of in the middle of that right now.
You're listening to Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison, and we've been talking with photographer Susan Worsham and Gordon Stettinius and Amy Ritchie from Candela Books and Gallery. A powerful exhibit of Worsham's work called Bittersweet on Boswick Lane is currently on display at Candela. For more on that, you can go to candelabooks.com. And for more on Susan, you can log on at susanworshamphotography.com. Thanks, you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for January 25th, 2013. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and our board op is Brian Mr. Mystery Hill. Mr. Dovey's wardrobe is courtesy of Mike McKenzie. Have you visited our tricked-out new website at rvaopensource.com? That's where you'll find breaking news, show podcasts, and additional information on our interview subjects. If the good Lord's willing and the creek stays low, we'll see you next week on Open Source RVA.
Oh, yeah. Well, I turned my feelings on the side. Yeah, yeah, like I'm gonna ignite. I saw them stars go off.